Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. It's my wife Cynthia's restaurant. We're Alexandrian cuisine based on our family recipes, and we've turned it into a haven for writers. I believe you're number 166 that I've interviewed so far.
That's amazing.
I'm trying to keep track, but I don't think it's working well.
How dare you lose count?
So please check us out at elainesliterarysalon.com. You can find our upcoming schedule. We're doing usually at least one a week, and we have our podcast as well. We're number 4 on Apple, number 3 on Spotify for literary podcasts. It's a fun place to be, and thank you all for eating, too. You're keeping us in business and allowing us to offer this to authors. And if you're an author and you're looking for a place to celebrate your work, please reach out to me, Jeffrey at jeffreyjameshiggins.com, and we'll find time for you because we're all in this together, right?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I've been looking forward to chatting with you since, I guess, we met,
BoucherCon?
We were signing together in BoucherCon, that is for sure. No, I met you at Thriller Fest. You're hitting all the big conferences. I love it.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so Pooja Guha is the author of 7 novels and 4 published short stories. Born into a family of acclaimed Indian architects, Pooja traveled with her parents as they worked on projects around the world. After graduating from the University of Pennsylvania, Pooja completed her master's degree in public policy at Sciences Po. Is that in Paris?
Yeah.
Sciences Po and the London School of Economics. Not too shabby, Pooja.
Thank you.
Today she works as an independent consultant on international development programs, primarily in Africa and South Asia, traveling to some of the most economically challenged countries in the world. Leveraging her scholarship, her ability to speak 5 languages, and her earnest goal of engineering global economic progress, she continues to learn about, support, and embrace new countries. Along her journey, she's been inspired by politics, culture, and setting to write the Ehrman Legacy series, in which she takes readers along with her as her imagination enhances her experiences. Pooja has lived in Kuwait, Toronto, Paris, London, and several American cities, including New York, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and San Francisco. She now lives in the Denver area. Her spy thriller series, The Ehrman Legacy, is an Amazon bestseller, and she's been featured on TV and media, including Fox 5, Reader's Digest, and the London Post. You can learn more about her at PoojaGuha.com. So, welcome to Elaine's. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's such a beautiful venue and an awesome opportunity to come out, to come back to D.C.
No, it's good to have you here. I mean, let me ask you, how much are you traveling for, like, this book series? Because I mentioned I saw you at 2 conferences, right? Is this how much do you do and how much do you think an author should do?
Oh, I mean, I think for me, I do about 3 conferences a year. I do Thriller Fest, BoucherCon, and Left Coast Crime. All 3 of those cover, they're different sizes, and so you get a different amount of quality time with people in the community, but you always meet new people every time. I think that's a good rhythm for me. That's not necessarily the best rhythm for everybody. I think it has to be fun. And then I add other local events or other ones where I travel, just kind of ad hoc, depending on as opportunities present themselves. I try not to say no, but I also try not to make myself crazy. So I enjoy travel and it works well for me. But I think it's important in this space to not be too prescriptive to people and not be like, you must attend X or do these things, because for some people it's really stressful and really, really a lot. It feels like a lot of extra work. And for me, it feels fun and it's an opportunity to reconnect with people and engage with the community in a relaxed way. And so I would say it's a balance for everybody. I mean, I think probably 1 to 2 conferences is good for most people, at least if they can. But it's hard to really give that sort of advice without knowing a little bit more about who's on the receiving end.
I love that you say you don't want to be prescriptive to people because everyone is so different. You know, when writers come in here, I tell them there is one rule for everyone, and that's write, right? Mm-hmm. But everything else. Do you find, like, are you an extrovert? Is that why you think you enjoy these conferences?
So I recently heard this term called ambivert, and I feel like that's where I am, which is, like, you're sort of an extrovert in communities where you have people in common and you have things you want to engage on, but you still also like to take time to recharge on your own. And I feel like that is a very good descriptor of me and probably a fair number of writers, because we do definitely, you know, writing is very solitary, and sometimes that's good and sometimes that's isolating, but we do, you know, want to socialize with our community and see friends and things like that, but also make sure to give ourselves time and space to recover and just reflect on things and walk around for me, like a lot of times I'll just walk around by myself, and that is time that I get lots of ideas and things just happen in my head. You know, you talk to your characters and do other weird things, but that's who we are.
Everybody here understands what you're talking about there. So some people who don't write might not. They might think it's a little crazy.
That's okay. I'm okay with that.
So for someone who is like an introvert and they go to conferences, and the reason I'm asking this is because that's how we met, and I've seen you at a bunch of these. What's the advice? Like, how you're introverted, you go to a conference, you don't know anybody or just a couple of people. What's the advice? Like, how do you meet new writers when you go to these things? And how do you get the most for your money? Because it's a big effort and expense to get to a conference.
Yeah, I think for an introvert, for sure, I would say, like, just every day, try and just walk up to one person. I feel like that is, in itself, like, you know, choose a small group. I wouldn't try and approach maybe a group of 10 people that are deep in conversation, but a group of 3 or 4 people, and you'll sort of see that they'll be very welcoming, and then just have a conversation, and you know, see where you're at. I think for people who are really introverted, especially as they are developing the community, if they don't know anybody, like, give yourself time to, you know, stay in the conference hotel, like, give yourself, okay, I'm going to go take a nap for an hour, or I am going to do XYZ just on my own, give myself a little bit of space and recovery, but I'm going to then actually come back. I'm going to come back to the bar at 5, or I'm going to go back to just the main lobby. I feel like at conferences, you can just walk up to people. Sometimes the bar can be loud or intimidating. So it's, yeah, just pick a spot and try and have a 2 or 3 conversations a day. And I feel like that in itself will kind of change the perception, which can help change the energy.
You know, that's really good advice. And I always see this, like, aha moment when you have someone who's new, like a new writer, and they come to one of these things, they start talking to other writers, and they realize, especially in this space, like mystery, thriller, suspense, writers are so friendly and welcoming. But that moment when they start talking and they realize everybody's going through all the same problems that they have, like, it never occurred to them that every problem they have and every self-doubt, every other writer's experiencing daily. Did that happen to you when you first started?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I had so much imposter syndrome about, like, have I really written enough? You know, do I belong in this group? And what am I doing here? And, yeah, I just walked up to someone at the bar and started, I just said, "Hi, I'm Pooja. This is my first," I think it was Thriller Fest. That's right, yeah, that was my first one. And then we just started talking, and they were super nice and welcoming, and here we are.
So tell us about this series. It's 5 books now, right?
Yeah, 5 books in the series.
When did the first book come out?
2014.
Okay, so fairly recently. So you're churning these things out pretty fast, because you're doing other things. You're writing short stories. You've done other work as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a journey. It was... So I had that idea for that first book when I was visiting Kuwait, which was home at the time. I grew up there, and my parents were still living there. And there's some weird nuances about Kuwait's political system that inspired this idea about why wouldn't... So Kuwait, for background, has a democratically elected parliament, but a monarchy, and they are sort of forced to work together, but it isn't the way you would think. The monarchy is actually more progressive than parliament. Parliament does have a small faction that is pretty progressive in terms of women's rights and civil rights, but the vast majority are very, very conservative, to the point that I would call them Islamist. And what happens is that the monarchy will try and pass kind of new cutting-edge legislation, which is really not super cutting-edge, but they'll try and do something, and then the monarchy will butt heads with parliament. The emir, the monarch, fires parliament, and then the same parliament, actually usually more conservative, is reelected a couple months later. And that tension just felt like, why wouldn't someone in the Islamist majority of parliament hire an assassin to get rid of the emir? Because it would solve a lot of their problems. And so that is the inspiration of the first book in my series. It had happened when I was home that trip. The emir fired parliament for something like the 10th time in 8 years, something crazy like that.
So was this, did you like know you wanted to write and you were just looking for something to write about? Or did you see this like kind of great natural conflict that exists there and say, oh, what fertile ground for a thriller?
Yeah, it was really what fertile ground for a thriller. I was a big reader. I read everything off of my parents' bookshelves very, very young. Some things too young. Like I read The Godfather when I was 9. It was not a, you know, my dad probably should have put that one on a different shelf. But that's not how it went. So I had all these thrillers that I had read growing up, like floating in the back of my mind, and you know, books that I was reading. And so then I just had that idea and was like, oh, I should try that out. This is something that I should try doing. And then in the process of writing, I realized this was not going to be just like a hobby that I did for one book. It was going to be something that I did for the rest of my life.
So when you read a powerful book like The Godfather in this your early development, do you think that really kind of sticks with you? Because you end up writing about an assassin, right? Like an assassination. So, you know, do you think that kind of thing sticks with you at an early age and somehow like formats the way that you look at story going forward? Like maybe had you spent more time with like Alice in Wonderland, would you be writing something very different right now?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. You know, I mean, I did read non-thrillers too. Most of my mom's books were sort of classics, but I read so many thrillers. It was like the thing that my dad and I always bonded about. We were always talking about books or arguing about movies and really going into story and talking about that. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think that's very much in the back of my mind. And also the fact that I read a lot of books that involved international settings and thrillers that had, you know, spies that were in different places all the time. And I also grew up all over the place. And so that for sure has impacted my writing.
So do you remember like which books or which authors impacted you the most in that time period? I'm always interested because you can see like shadows of it later in people's writing.
I would say number one would probably be Frederick Forsyth. I've read all of his early stuff multiple times, absolutely loved it. So The Day of the Jackal, certainly being about an assassin, I for sure that's in there. And I still once, like kind of once every 2 or 3 years, I try and like go back or either listen to the audiobook or reread one of those original classics. But I also read Icon. I read that instead of studying for my 10th grade history final, but I knew all about the Cold War because of it. You know, it was, I didn't need to read that history again because it was really all there. So Frederick Forsyth would be the biggest one. I think John Grisham was up there. I read some Michael Crichton. I read Timothy Zahn. I think those would be the biggest ones, though, that come to mind.
Did you meet John Grisham when you were at Thriller Fest this last year?
I saw him. I didn't get to actually meet him, unfortunately.
Have you met some of like your literary idols or people that influenced you so much in the past? What's that like when you meet somebody that you've been reading forever? Because it's such an intimate relationship between a reader and an author.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten to meet definitely some of the some of the greats that I've read a bunch of. I haven't met at this stage, and I mean, sadly, force it passed, but I haven't met an author that influenced me at that level. I think that would be a really different experience. But I've still been very lucky to meet, you know, when Lee Child was still coming to conferences, I met him. I met the author who wrote Rambo. I'm blanking on his name.
David Morrell.
Yes, yes. That was really amazing. And it's amazing to see that they're just real people. And they've also had so many of the same struggles that we've had. You know, like, I sat and just, like, had a drink with Heather Graham, and she was just such a warm and wonderful person. You know, like that kind of vibe, I think, is really amazing. Certainly from all the authors that are coming to conferences or events, I think that in this genre, we're really, really lucky to have that camaraderie and collaborative spirit and supportive network.
It's so interesting when you see someone with that level of success for so many decades, right, of publishing and bestsellers, but they're still craving the same thing. They still want to talk to other writers. They still want to work through problems. And some of them, shockingly, still have that imposter syndrome you talked about. Does that ever really go away?
Not completely. I now can reground myself and be like, wait, you actually did those things. You know, you wrote those books. And they can't have all been bad because of the reception. So let's just remember that you will get through this, whichever stage is of the next book that is problematic. So sometimes it's, I can't imagine how I'm going to get through those edits, or I don't know how I'm going to do that. Or a lot of times I find when it's revisions, you'll get a note that on the surface doesn't make sense, right? It's just like, no, that's not right, but there's kind of this note behind the note that you have to find, and then you have to address that. And it's like, I mean, the easiest example I'll give is not from one of my editors, but it's from my dad, who is one of my, every time my dad's reading a new book, I'm just like, oh God, what is he going to say? Because he doesn't pull his punches, which is good, which is part of why I want him to read my stuff. But you know, he made a comment about my standalone psychological thriller, where he was like, I don't think that it was a supporting character, a young woman who was really, really struggling emotionally with some stuff that happens in the book around abuse and things. And I don't think that she would need therapy. She seems like a very strong person. First, it just made me mad because I was like, Dad, how can you think that strong women don't need therapy? Like, asking for help is a, you know, a sign of strength, not weakness. But I was like, okay, how do I figure this out? Because, you know, we're definitely exposing a generational difference, a cultural difference, like all of that kind of stuff. And it's like, okay, so I'm not going to actually change the fact that this character seeks out and needs therapy, but how can I bolster the understanding of the reader, you know, someone who has the same background as my dad, like why she would still need it and why it would actually be good for her. And so, you know, that finding that note behind the note was very difficult. And sometimes that happens with other notes where it's just like, either you just completely disagree and it bothers you deeply emotionally that the comment was even made, and then you have to figure out, well, I still have to address this. I'm not going to address it the way they said.
You make a really interesting point, right, with the different age, different culture. So, like, who is your audience for these books, right? this Ehrman series, for example?
I mean, I think the audience is actually quite broad. I think that, I mean, traditionally, in terms of how we think about audience, you know, so it'd be adults, although there's nothing in the books that, let's say, a teenager couldn't read. I wouldn't really recommend it for younger than that. But in the thriller space, I think sometimes we tend to think that, like, if it's an action, if the book has action, then it's only for men, which I think is ludicrous. Not, you know, this group wouldn't think that, but I suspect that as a genre, sometimes, like, anything with action is like, oh, it's for men, even though actually the vast majority, you know, a large portion of readers are women. And my aim as a writer is to try and make it accessible to everybody. So, like, yes, am I talking about nuances of Middle East politics? For sure I am. But I'm explaining them enough, but in the context of the story, that it doesn't mean that somebody has to have had exposure to that growing up. Am I writing about, you know, a mixed race character who is from the Middle East? Yes. But at the same time, you know, we're sort of explaining enough that it's accessible to a vast audience of readers. I would say that, you know, probably, I mean, there's an important romantic thread like throughout the series, but maybe like someone who is focused on like, whose primary genre is pure romance might not gravitate towards the book. But if they're sort of open to a mix, you know, that could work. Or someone who is a very devoted sci-fi reader would find that, you know, this is very like grounded in modern day and real life. So it might not be the exact appeal. But in terms of I try not to narrow the audience too much.
Do you have any insight into who's actually buying the book, whether it's through like Facebook or Amazon ads or people clicking or from anywhere else? Do you know who the majority of your readers are?
I mean, I know little details. I would say that, you know, most of them are in the U.S., but there's a chunk that are all over. You know, I definitely see and hear from readers in India, in different parts of Europe, in Canada, in Australia. Those are but I haven't been asking them, so it's really self-selective. It's the ones who've reached out to me, and then, you know, you can get a little bit of detail from like the click data or from the newsletter, but even then, you know, not everybody's going to put their country of residence in the information when they sign up for the newsletter. So it's hard to say. I mean, do you know when you're like
from things like Facebook ads, right? They can tell you like gender and age groups, and so that gives you a good idea on each individual book, like who it's appealing to.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, in terms of like those very broad demographics, like I would say 25 to 65. I don't remember the percentages, but I have looked at them. I've tried not to give them too much weight, though, because like if I were to think about how I would target, well, certainly not from a writing perspective. Like I'm not writing differently, keeping in mind that other than explaining, you know, some of the relevant history and things like that, you know, which a 70-year-old would have different knowledge of potentially than a 25-year-old, but that could also be hugely varied depending on where they grew up.
So how do you draw that balance? Like when you're writing a book that's set in another country, like how much history or culture do you have to explain? Because like my wife writes a lot of, you know, Middle Eastern affairs, and if she's writing for a Middle Eastern audience, she writes it completely differently because there's a base of common knowledge that everybody knows, and if she goes too into it, she'll turn people off, right? But if she's writing for an American audience, she has to go much deeper into it. So in fiction, like how do you balance that?
I think by spreading it out, I mean, you do have to give the details. I think most of the time the details are actually really interesting to people. But you just sort of, you don't give it to them all at once. You know, a lot of times when I'm writing a first draft, I put them all in at once. And then I have to revise that and kind of distribute that information, you know, move some of it later in the book, move some of it into dialogue where it would make sense, like depending on who the characters are. You know, one of the books in the series takes place in Burundi, a small country in East Africa. And but the main character of the book is a foreigner. And so that gave me a lot of room to write about a lot of the cultural experiences that I had when I started working there. And that sort of feeling of how you get exposed to a new place and discover new things, and then how I fell in love with the place. And so I got to do that with my character. So, I mean, I think it really depends, but it for sure the biggest trick would be distribute the information so it's not all at once, because they're no reader is going to absorb it if you give it to them all at once anyway. But
so what's your rule on that? Like how much like info dump can you do at a time? How much backstory? How much history? Do you limit yourself to a paragraph, or like, or do you just kind of feel the pacing as you go?
I mean, if I'm writing a first draft and the info dump is what is flowing, I don't stop it. I just write it and then I just fix it later. But if I've done a huge one, let's say in chapter two or something, then, you know, in my first big revision, I'll be printing out the book and I'll be writing on the pages like, oh, wow, that starts over here. And that continues for a while. We are going to either... And then a lot of times what will happen for me is I don't even have to repeat it elsewhere. Like, it's come out some other way because it's come out in the context of, like, the action or the dialogue of the story, in which case I can just be like, okay, can I cut 100% of that paragraph? Yes, other than this, like, one little detail. Okay, I'm going to put that later. And then that just streamlines the process. But I definitely... For me, if I'm writing a first draft, I don't constrain anything if it's flowing. If it's not flowing, then I go back to an outline or think about and redoing that part of the outline to get flowing. But if that's what's happening and it's info dump, I just try not to judge myself, which I still do, but I try not to.
So when you go through and you see, oh, this has already come out someplace else, was that done purposely? Were you trying to like do double duty with like a piece of dialogue that's showing both history and character or something, or is it just something that naturally comes out where you're in a different setting?
Mostly it's something natural. Like if it is something that was flowing and important to me to remind myself of early on, it kind of comes back somehow in part of the story later. And then there's also the trick of, like, there are certain really important details that if you just brush over at once, your reader might not actually remember. So it's a little bit of a nuanced trick, because you might have to remind them that is important, but without repeating yourself. And without, if the original place that you put it in was, you know, part of way too much information, they're not going to care. Not going to actually remember it anyway. So, yeah, it's definitely a little bit of, you know, treading a fine line of what's important, what do we need to remind them of, what can we just cut and they can figure it out. You know, that's all stuff that, you can't be prescriptive about any of that. You just have to, like, feel what's right in the moment and go for it.
I hear that a lot, and I know a lot of new writers, they look at that and they cringe because they're like, what do you mean feel? How do I know? How do I know what advice to take? How do I know when the pacing's off, right? Does this come from reading widely in the genre, or does it come from just writing a lot of words, or maybe a little bit of both?
I think both. I think for sure. I think the type of feedback that, well, for sure... Any feedback that comes from like a few of my very, very trusted early readers, I take it on board in some form. And a lot of times it is like looking for a note behind the note. Or the feedback will be really general, which I think is like the best editors give that kind of general feedback. Like, I think you need to make this scene bigger. What does that mean? No idea. When you first hear the thing, you have no clue. Does that mean more action? Does that mean more tension? Does that mean longer? The answer can really be any of the above, and you really have to think about what feels right for your characters, your story. Give yourself the time to think about that, and then once you have an answer, trust it.
So you have these five books. I never know how to talk about series because each book like stands alone, but are there themes that run throughout the five books?
Yes. Yeah. So I mean, the biggest theme would be what is what is it possible for someone to redeem themselves from? So the assassin's character, the Ahriman, that's his code name, he starts out as a pretty normal guy and then has, you know, a bunch of really horrible things happen to him, and then he's blackmailed and all this stuff and ends up doing a lot of terrible things. And the biggest part of the story is, you know, can he redeem himself? For his arc is really about whether or not that is possible. And, you know, for Petra, the protagonist of the story, whether she agrees and believes that's possible for him too. And it's really about that journey of the two of them together, and whether redemption is something we really believe in. Depending on, you know, it's one of those things that's very easy to say, like anyone can come back from, you know, everyone deserves a second chance, like all of that stuff. And it's like, well,
is that really true?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that, you know, his character does pretty much everything in his power to redeem himself. But I think the choice of whether he can be forgiven or not is in the eye of the beholder. You know, whether a reader thinks he can and should be forgiven is different from whether he can even forgive himself, and whether the other characters can too.
So when you have a strong arc, like a redemption arc, how do you do that over multiple books? Do you know in advance how many books you're planning to write?
I didn't. I thought it would be a 3-book series. And when I got to the end of the second book, it was like, oh yeah, no, it's going to need more. I had ideas of how I would end the series, but I hadn't decided yet. It didn't really come to me until I was writing the fourth book. At the time of the fourth book, I knew how the fifth book would end, but not really how we would get there. But I think, you know, people do it differently. So some authors would chalk, you know, every detail. Like I can't do an outline like, well, I've done it for one book. I did a detailed outline. Even then, I didn't do chapter by chapter outlining. Because for me, that took some of the fun away, the discovery. But, you know, that is what works for other authors. And that's great. You know, it's very individual. And I think as a community, we should definitely accept that and let new authors like find their own way. I think it's very funny that at every conference we always have a plotters versus pantsers panel, and I think it's interesting for readers, but it always becomes this weird debate of like plotting is better and pantsing is better, and it's like no, one is better for you and one is better for me, and it's okay.
I think in those panels, it always kind of turns out that everyone's just somewhere on that spectrum, you know, and people are closer, and they're, you know, even the, I'm a pure pantser, you know, I'm a discovery writer, but then they know the ending when they go into it, or they know the big twist. So when you're doing this with over a series, do you find you have to flatten like the internal arc, like the character arc, because you have multiple books to go, or do you have arcs within each book, like character change that's occurring in each and going in one direction?
I have arcs within each book, for sure. I think that, yeah, there's individual arcs within each book. There's sort of overall movement towards where I end up, but at the same time, in between, it's, you know, human beings, we don't change all at once. So, like, and it's not like 25% of the change happens in book two and 50%, but, you know, an additional 25%, you know, it's like, oh, there's a big moment, but then there might be a regression or something like that, just because human emotions are not linear. And so I don't really worry about that too much. I think if I was writing a 20-book series, I would be very concerned. But I feel like in this case, I was writing, you know, the full arc of where the story had to be for the two lead characters. And it just happened naturally. It wasn't difficult to plot out. But I do think that you're right, when people are writing series where it's like, okay, one book takes place every year, or I had to show progression with a character. I mean, some authors just don't age their characters at all, which is great for the work that they've done. And then some authors, you know, add little details like, oh, the girlfriend got pregnant, so that's how we're going to know that he's different from, you know, two books ago, or that kind of thing. But in my case, it was very clear the sort of journey the two of them had to be on, and where they were away from each other versus together just really dictated how that would make sense.
I'm curious, like, in the character creation, like, do you have, like, this redemption? Is that how it first came to you, and then you kind of build out the character from there? Like, I mean, you know, these are complex characters. So walk us through that process a little bit.
I mean, I knew redemption would be a big part of the story, but I hadn't really decided whether he could be redeemed or not. I knew he was going to try, and I knew he was going to do everything that he could, but at the same time, you can't change the past. You know, you cannot erase what has already happened. So I knew that that was going to be a big theme. I think it became even more so over the course of the books as I got to know my characters better, as I put them in different situations. It sort of even changed my mind in a way. I wouldn't necessarily say that someone who's done the terrible things that he did deserves redemption, but I think that he at least was able to earn the opportunity to have a different life. And I do think that people can change that. I think that probably, maybe that's the influence, going back to your earlier question, like, you know, one of the biggest things that I read a lot of Star Wars, and that was my, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy was a big part of, like, you know, my dad and I bonded over it and rewatched it so many times. So I do think a lot about, you know, this sort of, like, light side, dark side, what we can come back from. And that obviously is a huge arc of that story. So I think that that is a big player in the background of this book, series too.
It's really interesting that you were trying to figure that out as you wrote the books, as it developed. Did you, and I talked to a lot of authors who write series and other standalones, do you find comfort in that series? You say you get to know the characters, you have them, you've created a world, you've populated it with characters, or at some point do you want to write something that's very different?
I mean, I think it's a lot of fun to have the series, but for now, after the fifth book, I feel very comfortable working on other things. I do have a couple of supporting characters that are showing up in one of the new books that I'm working on, and that's really fun because he's my favorite character, and you know, I have thought about having, like, of that character having his own series, which I haven't decided at this point. He's still a supporting character in the new book that I've been working on, but it's really fun to write scenes with him because I already know him, and I can use that to my advantage.
So sharing characters, and it's really interesting because when you write a series, there's something like a 40% rate of readers that go from book to book. Mm-hmm. And so, but when you're doing standalones, you have to start over with each one, right? It relies more on concept and new characters and things. But you're still sort of writing in that world.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. So do you think the readers of this first five book series will be an easy lift for you to get them into the new stuff?
I mean, I think that for sure, they'll be, because I do think that a lot of people really like that character, so I think they'll be excited to see him again. But I do think the bigger part of, like, the audience lift will be around the main themes of the book. But I do think it will be fun for my existing series readers to be like, oh, Santiago's going to be back. That's great. You know. So
the new book is also, like, espionage, assassination. Is it the same type of thriller?
It's definitely espionage. It is a little bit more, you could almost call it, like, meets domestic suspense. I'm not amazing with the way publishing does genres, especially because I often find that, like, espionage thrillers are sort of combined with like military and action thrillers, and I think that they can be very different. Sometimes they can also be both. So it's about a woman working for the World Bank, which I used to, but in West Africa. And she starts dating a Nigerian businessman. She gets engaged to him, and then she gets picked up by an independent intel agency because he is running drugs through his resorts that he owns, or at least that's what they tell her. And so she has to decide who she wants to trust and who she wants to believe and what she's willing to do for that. So that is the broad theme of the book. And it will be, I believe, a new series. I have a little bit of book two and three mapped out, but not definitely not the whole thing.
What creates a spark for that? Do you start with the plot, or because of all these international settings, you look at setting and say, what can I do here? Like, for this specific idea, where did that come from?
This specific idea came from, so I worked in Guinea-Bissau, a small country in West Africa, many years ago. It was my first project with the World Bank right out of grad school, and it was, like, think of the pinnacle of, like, 25-year-old idealist. Like, we were going to just solve all the problems and everything was going to be amazing. And Guinea-Bissau is a beautiful country. It's got a really, really interesting history, but a really rough history. And I sort of, like, glossed over that when I was thinking about the work we were going to be doing. And it just... So, for context, Guinea-Bissau is primarily a cashew economy, officially. But unofficially, it is also a cocaine economy. And that was really, really hard for me in this place that I visited on my first project, and I thought we were going to do amazing work. And then a month later, there was a military coup, and our project got suspended, and then nothing happened. And then, you know, I learned a lot more about, like, how minimal the actual investment we were making was going to be, and just all of this, like, fall from idealism. And it took me a really long time. I knew I was going to write something about the drug trade in Guinea-Bissau. I knew I was going to do it eventually, but I didn't know when. And it's taken me over 10 years to be able to, like, really engage with that place again, because it was so dear, but it was also just so sad to acknowledge that, like, it would be... It's not like things are impossible to change. I don't believe that. But it is so hard to actually make real change, because there's just so many things that have to go right. You know, one, you can't keep having military coups. That has to stop. And then you have to have, you know, economic opportunity. You have to have development opportunity. You know, there has to be enough stability. Guinea-Bissau is also really geographically challenged as part of what makes it so beautiful. They have 300 islands. But imagine trying to police 300 islands. You know, it makes sense that this is an easy hub for drugs to be deposited. And then, because it's very close to Europe, for drugs to enter Europe. And it's been happening for decades. And so it was really, really sad. But at the same time, that is where the idea came from.
So you waited a decade to write this to give yourself some space. When you're writing about stuff that causes frustration or has some emotional impact for you, do you find that there's, like, a catharsis that happens when you're writing about it? Or is it just sort of painful and bringing back a lot of bad emotions? Like as a writer, right? Because you're doing this. This is self-imposed. is it a painful process going through that?
I think it's very cathartic, but you have to be ready. So it in this case, because of how idealistic I was when I worked in Guinea-Bissau, I wasn't ready for a long time. But, you know, other parts of that book take place in Nigeria, where I worked very recently, and that was a lot less raw for me. You know, that was like, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to write that. And I know exactly, I'm going to set it in the same hotel, and I know exactly what's going to happen because I just experienced it. Myself. And so it really varies. You know, I mentioned the book that's set in Burundi earlier. Like, that was really cathartic because I had just stopped working there and I really loved it. And so I got to go back there through that experience and have my characters fall in love with the place the way I did. I also, one of the books that I am working on, which is outside of this series and outside of the series that I mentioned that's in Guinea-Bissau, is an alternate history where the CIA orchestrated coup in the 50s in Iran fails and the whole thing's classified and covered up. And so growing up in the Middle East, it is something that I have thought about a lot, that like, how different would this region that I grew up in look if the biggest democracy had remained a democracy? And so that is something that I have thought about many times, and like being able to write the book was very cathartic. I do think that, I mean, the whole thing's very complicated and sad, and I think a lot of times, sometimes you see alternate history things, and it's like, oh, it would be so bleak if, you know, like the one of the big ones, obviously, is the Man in High Castle, right? It's like, so if the Axis powers had won World War II, things would be bleak. Things would be really bleak. But in this case, what I was writing was a lot more like, well, some things would be better, and some things would just be different. And so it was a lot for me to figure out what I believed would actually happen and emotionally what I wished would happen, and then what the story would be within that.
Such a fascinating idea. I'm looking forward to reading that one. So when you are writing like a character in another country, different culture, you know, perception and the lens through which your character's looking at things is different. It's based on a shared history. It's based on, you know, different experience. When you're writing that, and for, say, like, you know, a U.S. market, which is one of the biggest markets, when you're writing for that, do you worry about, like, the way that they're looking at things or interpreting things won't be as relatable to, like, somebody here?
Yeah. I mean, I do worry about that, but I try and sort of just give enough detail to change the... To provide enough awareness for the perception. And I definitely just sort of try and, depending on what it's about, you know, get enough people to read and look at the material and see, you know, like, what are the perceptions? Like, the biggest thing in that book that I encountered was people from my parents' generation, who grew up in the U.S., a lot of times the perception was that the Shah of Iran, who was ousted in 79, was actually a positive figure. And I couldn't believe that is what, you know, with the media that they grew up with, that's what they saw. And that, you know, was really something where I was like, oh, I really need to give a lot more description on what that was actually like, which is, you know, yes, was he pro-Western? Absolutely. But at the same time, you know, he had a crazy secret police that was running around, you know, pulling people out of their homes. And so it was really a surprise for me that perception existed. And it was like a wake-up call, because it's like, oh, wow. Even, you know, given, like, just what has happened in history since then, and, you know, but it's just so different from the news that I grew up with. I was very surprised.
So when you're explaining that, like, if you want to, like, hang a lantern on it, right, so people can understand that people will not get what you're saying at first, do you use that same tool you talked about earlier, where you maybe have, like, a foreign character who's there that somebody has to explain something to them, or that they can notice that something is a little bit different than what they would have thought?
Yeah, I think a foreign character is very useful for that kind of thing, and often present anyway. A little bit of dialogue, and then some just clearer descriptors. So, like, the biggest thing that I used for that piece in the book was talking a little bit more about, you know, in this alternate version of Iran, there was, like, a much more vibrant, like, and overt, like, Jewish quarter in Tehran, which existed, but is, and still does to a certain extent, but is, like, very much under the table now and, like, hidden. And so I kind of used that detail to really highlight the difference and talk about, in this case, like, a character is discussing, like, oh, wow, you know, the person who would have been in charge if the coup had succeeded. But that's obviously very, very specific. But things like that, just sort of seeing where the story is and making sure that some of those salient details like really are put in there.
So I'm going to go to audience questions in just a second. I just want to ask you, I've talking to a lot of new writers, and you're obviously, you work a lot. you've got time, but you're prolific. Oh, what has been your key to like developing writing habit, and how is it that you're able to like consistently write?
I mean, for me, so regardless of what your schedule is, you know, whether it's day job, family, all the things, like number one, you are a writer, and that is also another job. That's hard to think about. You know, that's hard. You know, it's hard for people to understand. But it's very much like it is another profession. And so it is, you know, just like it would be okay to change certain things or orient your schedule around something from any job, it is okay for you to do that. And so it is okay to prioritize this, and you should, because it is a job, it is a profession. And so, you know, depending on what your schedule is, that looks very different for people. You know, I have friends who wake up at 5 a.m. and they like to write for 2 hours before their kids wake up. That would not work for me. I do not do 5 a.m. Unless I am jet lagged, in which case I hate everybody and everything. But for me, what that looks like is I try and dedicate my morning to writing. I do have a lot more control of my schedule because I was freelance when I was working for the World Bank. Now a friend and I have our own company. So as long as the work gets done, nobody's really policing when that is. So I do have a lot of flexibility that many people would probably not have. And I'm very grateful for that. But it is also my choice. I did choose a life with more volatility because I wanted to prioritize my writing. And that doesn't mean that that's, you know, the best choice for everybody. Not at all. But that was my trade-off. And so that way I can allocate a chunk of my morning most days to hit. And I work to, if I'm writing a first draft, I work to a word count target. Usually that's 1,500 words. If I'm traveling, that's 500. And some days that's fast. Some days it's easy because the words are flowing and it's like, oh my gosh, I feel so good. Even if I don't do anything else today, I look at what I've accomplished. And then other days it's like the whole day you still can't get your target, or like you're really just barely scraping by. That's the way I do it. I also, in the last couple years, started doing one or more, if I can, writer's retreats every year where I do them unstructured. So I choose a place that I want to go to. Usually for me, because I love hiking, like it's a place that I can go with my dog and I'll write all morning. And I have
what kind of dog?
Oh, she's a lab border collie mix. Yeah. So I'll write all morning, usually to like 3,000 words minimum. And there's something about not being home and just not having to do laundry or cook dinner or something that just makes me a lot more productive. And then I'll usually have hit the target by around noon or 1 p.m. And then after that, any more writing that I do is optional. And I can just spend the rest of the day on the mountain, on the trail, with Sally, my dog.
Do you find when you're hiking that the ideas come to you while you're in motion and letting your mind wander?
Yes, for sure. I do think that movement is an incredibly powerful tool for ideas, for anybody. You know, some people might not like hiking as much as I do. I'm a little bit crazy. But absolutely, there's just the setting and, I don't know, being out in nature, clear mountain air, and the exertion that sort of takes you out of your head, but then you still have ideas that pop up afterwards or during.
And how do you remember those ideas?
I usually write them in a note in my phone. If they're a good idea, I don't let them escape. So once in a while, I'll be like, oh, I have to go to the side of the trail and write this down. And my dog is like, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, Sally, you're going to have to wait.
All right, last question before we go to the audience questions. I ask every author this one question, and that's, where do you think story comes from? And I've had some really interesting ideas. So you're walking, and you get these plots form in your head, or this new character comes alive for you. Where did that come from?
I mean, I think it is really like you described it. Just it's a little bit random, but a lot of times it comes from, for me, it comes from travel. And that might be, you know, a mountain in Colorado or Jackson, Wyoming, or it is, you know, a place in Africa that I've never visited before. And all of those places have inspired stories and characters for me. It's just that discovery of new experience, I think, and then letting yourself explore those ideas. And then it turns into story.
Oh, that's fun. I like that answer. All right, I'm going to come around. Please use the microphone so it comes out on the podcast.
Thanks a lot. You talked about the balance of, you know, the historical backload or, you know, knowledge drop versus, you know, not overtaking the story or the audience. How do you consider, or where do you factor in accuracy into that and the need to be 100% accurate, or are there areas where you fudge because it helps the story and it doesn't really matter? I mean, I'm not talking about, like, you know, deciding somebody else was president or, you know, whatever, but what is the correct balance for you? And please be as prescriptive as possible.
I think it is... If I want to change something about the circumstance of the place, I try and figure out a reason for that to make sense. So, like, one of the books in the series, a big chunk of it is set in the northern part of Madagascar. And in a place that I worked, and we were trying very hard to bring a bunch of additional solar power to the region. And that region is very much in need of that power. And so... in this case, because the series was set in the near future, I said that they had built those power plants. And so the resort where I set a lot of the big scenes, which is where I stayed, was very different. Like, it was much more vibrant. I mean, it's still beautiful, because it absolutely was before, but they didn't have power cuts, and it made a lot more sense for a very wealthy businessman to have his to have that as the venue for his daughter's wedding, which is what was happening in the background of the story. That's a very, like, clear, overt, like, I changed this about this place. I think with other stuff, well, I'm supposed to be prescriptive, so, you know, you absolutely cannot change anything ever, but, you know, for the story's sake, you can change whatever you want. I mean, I think in a way that is true. It's what I try to always be true to, even if I'm changing something, you know, more specific, is sort of like the spirit of a place or history. If it's a history thing, I do try and give a reason. But if it's a place, the biggest things that I want to make sure are conveyed are sort of like the level of, like, cultural nuance. 'Cause we deal with a lot of perceptions, right? Like, perceptions about, for example, like ones that I grew up with about the Middle East, or it's like, well, things are always bad and women are always, you know, really struggling, and, like, you know, things like that are extreme. And so I try and showcase that is not actually the case, but within the context of the story. So providing some of that nuance and being true to that spirit of the place, even if I might, you know, it's not convenient for me that hotel is over there, so I'm going to put it somewhere else, you know, on the coastline or something like that. I think that's generally fine. Maybe I'd rename it in that case so it's clear that it's not the same thing. But yeah, that's sort of how I would approach this concept in general about changing things.
Question over here.
Have you ever read a review or gotten a reader response or note to you that you found was actually really helpful? And if so, what was it? Or have you ever gotten a response or a review that was just so awful that you had to really think about it?
The reader reviews that I've thought about the most are a little odd because they were clearly not about my book, and so I was just, but I was mystified. I was like, there are two of them, and one of them referenced a misspelling of Henry David Thoreau, and I was like, what on earth? And it had been a while since the book had come out, so I was like, did I make some kind of weird reference, or at least something that could be perceived that I was trying to say Henry David Thoreau? So I like really went back and looked at the book to try and find that. It was not there. It was not about my book. But I think it's been really cool to see readers that have, you know, minimal, like, you know, they have not been to the Middle East, or they haven't been to different parts of Africa where I've sent my stuff, like when they've written to me and been like, that was really, really cool to see. And I was really interested, you know, because I think sometimes I, in my own like imposter syndrome traps, have been like, nobody's going to want to read about something that's set in this like less sexy location, like Northern Madagascar, or, you know, they want to read books that are in London or in Paris or in DC, but they don't want to read about these random locations, or I wouldn't call them random, but these smaller, less popular locations. And that's really not been true. And I think that was getting that feedback was some of the most exciting that I've seen.
Other questions over here?
So I'm wondering about how does AI, what kind of a place does AI have vis-a-vis the author, this day and age? Does it enhance your process, or is it deleterious to your process? How do you see it?
I mean, I try not to worry about it too much. I think that it is for sure beyond my control, like if AI develops the ability to write like I do, although I don't actually think so. I use AI for research in my public policy and my consulting work, and it's an amazing tool. There's no question about it. I think sometimes it's egregiously wrong, and you know, it requires a lot of supervision and checking. But it's incredible what it's able to do. There's no other way to put that, and the type of research that it's able to synthesize so quickly. I wouldn't use it for writing fiction, for sure. I think we've had it help us with the company, you know, write like introductions and conclusions. I think it's actually quite good at those, but it's not writing with soul. You know, we're talking about like it read my LinkedIn profile and generated a paragraph on my bio, or read our company's website and was like, okay, for this proposal that you're submitting, like, this is the most important, like, the five salient points about why you would be submitting on this. So for that kind of writing that doesn't require an emotional heart, I think it's okay. It still has made weird mistakes that I like. It conflates. There's a professor who's also named Pooja Guha, and it regularly confuses me with her. And it's very entertaining once in a while. It's like, oh, really? How did you get that? I put, you know, you have my LinkedIn profile, which clearly doesn't say I teach in Georgia, but. In I think for research, it's incredibly powerful. For some of the like I used it in a book that I am working on to get topographical images of a particular part of this island, and you know, it's a place that I have been to, but not, I needed to have a particular kind of house in that setting, and I needed to make sure that that would work. And then, so I looked at those types of pictures between a couple of different places on the island and then chose one. So for research, I think it's an incredible tool, but it's obviously very problematic that, you know, authors' work has been uploaded in there and, you know, they're not getting compensated and all of that stuff. I was lucky enough to find that my work wasn't in the big, you know, the huge amount that had been uploaded into the, as part of the most recent, like, compensation scheme. I checked and I found that my work wasn't there, which I was really surprised by, actually. But I definitely never put any of my fiction in there for editing or anything like that. I might consider, if I wrote my own synopsis, putting a synopsis in there and being like, how do I make it better? But that's about as close as I would take it to my fiction work outside of research.
Good answer. So this has been really fun. Where should people who are viewing this go to find your work?
Amazon is definitely the largest channel for being able to find all of my books. And it's, I think Amazon has actually been pretty supportive of authors. So, you know, people have different views about Amazon as a company, but I think for authors, it's been largely good. So that is my Amazon page, Pooja Guha. It's very easy to find me. All of my books are there. And then, of course, for my newsletter, that's pujaguha.com. You can always sign up anytime. And I will aspire to be more regular in my communication. It's not always the case, but I have been very lucky to have a really great list who are very understanding.
And you have some of your books here and also at least one of your anthologies, correct?
Yes.
For sale, okay. And you'll be signing?
Yeah, of course. Anyone who wants me to sign, I'll definitely sign.
All right, fantastic. I always ask people to go on Amazon and rate her books. It makes a big difference. It helps other people find a new author. And if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's, please rate us on Open Table or Google or wherever you rate restaurants. We really appreciate it. Pooja, this has been so much fun. Thank you very much. Well
done. Thank you. This has been amazing. And thank you all for coming.